well read. Search for truth is of course a very profound and in a way a difficult subject, and it would require a great deal of discussion, I think, to understand it. And I myself don't claim to speak with any kind of authority. It is the last thing I would try to do. But I am myself in my own way trying to find the truth. I am deeply interested in that. And so as a seeker, I perhaps can say a few words on the subject, as our president has asked me to do so. There are a lot of people now in the present world who are searching for truth. And there are also a lot of people who claim to be able to provide the truth. Yeah, and that is really the danger, because there are innumerable teachers now. In India itself, there are so many self-styled gurus. I have to ask pardon for using that word, but they are self-styled gurus. And each of them provides something which attracts disciples, followers to them. And when there are so many gurus, the temptation is, of course, to go to a guru and find an easy way to truth. I think it's an almost irresistible temptation. You feel that if only you could find the right guru, then truth will be at, truth can be reached. But how does one find the right guru? That is the great problem, because if a person can simply put on certain clothes, adopt certain attitudes, say that he can give solutions through certain types of mantras and meditation, does he become a guru? Is he capable of communicating enlightenment or truth in some form to another person? If that were so, every one of us could put on some costume and sit in a place, learn how to sit very quietly and, you know, adopt a certain formula and communicate it. That would be very easy. And so, perhaps not only the would-be disciples have the temptation of going to the gurus, but there is the temptation to become a guru. And it is a very real temptation. And any would-be disciple must be aware of this danger. It's so nice to be a guru, to have a lot of disciples, which means having cars and facilities and a certain kudos and position and everything. And so naturally many people will be tempted into that. And so anyone who searches for the truth has naturally to find out who is a true guru, who can teach, who is an enlightened one, who is a master. And how is one to find out if a man is enlightened or he is not enlightened? Perhaps only another enlightened man can say with certainty that a person, so-and-so, is enlightened. This is what Madame Blavatsky says in one of her books, that it is only an enlightened man who can really recognize another enlightened man. So that provides another problem for us. How do they recognize a guru? Suppose there is a real teacher, an enlightened person. What is the nature of that enlightenment? If we come into contact with the deep philosophy which is in every religion, it gives one to understand that the essence of spirituality is the absence of egoism. There is, in a way, it is so simple. If there is no egoism, if there is no jot of selfishness at all, then that is spirituality. Everyone has said this. The Vedanta has said it. The Taoist religion has said it. And one can find it in every kind of writing all over the world. And yet it is the most difficult thing to achieve. And we can see that all the problems of the world are really created by the sense of being separate, having separate needs, separate aims, ambitions, things which we want to achieve for ourselves. And every individual in the world has some little ambition, some little aim of his own, which is in contradiction with the aims of others. The very fact of having an aim to achieve makes us separate from somebody else. And so, if we did not have anything to achieve for ourselves, then the world could be quite a different place. And therefore the truly spiritual individual can contribute very much more to the world than any so-called practical man can. And therefore spirituality is closely connected with the question of compassion, which the Dalai Lama spoke about. The Buddha, it is said in one of our theosophical books, The Voice of the Silence, some of you may know it, that compassion is the mother of the Buddhas. It is when there is this feeling not of seeking for oneself, not even enlightenment, not trying to promote ourselves in any way, not trying even to survive in establish a position in the world. It may be an unknown position, it may be a position in a small circle, but then there is only a feeling of trying the betterment of the world as a whole, which includes the animals, the plants, the earth, all forms of life. When there is that feeling, out of it comes enlightenment. And that is the absolute contradiction of egoism. And so the mark of the true teacher, so far as I understand it from whatever study I have made, is that he must be an individual who has negated the self in him. And if that is so, would he say, I am a guru? The moment he says, I am this, whether he says, I am a rich man, I am a minister, or I am a guru, it is all the same thing, because he is creating a status for himself. He is claiming something for himself. So, if there is the absolute negation of the self, that enlightened person will never say, I am enlightened. I can teach. He may teach, but it is because he has compassion, not because he feels he is a teacher. And out of that negation of the self comes a totally different state of consciousness. It is what in Vedanta has been called the undivided consciousness, the integrated consciousness that yoga speaks of. Because what creates the kind of consciousness within the average man the ordinary man, which is a divided consciousness, is his pursuit. When the mind pursues something, I hope I'm not talking at too philosophical a level. If the mind is pursuing something and it holds to that thing, it absorbs that thing, it has taken the shape of that thing, it has created a little division within itself. That form of what it seeks is stored in that consciousness. And if we look at our own minds, we can see we have stored in our mind innumerable forms, ideas, images, concepts, including the concept we have of ourselves and of all the individuals whom we meet, what we think about them, the pleasures we have experienced, all that. The mind which moves, pursues pleasure, has an image of pleasure which it stores in itself. And every such little pursuit, every such little movement has created a division in the mind. It stores this image, that image, and so the mind is divided. And out of it come new pursuits, because we are seeking further pleasures, similar pleasures, keener pleasures, and so on. And so, the guru, who seeks nothing at all, in whom there is no sense of self, who has no aim for himself, on him, whose aim is the aim of all life, in him the mind is not divided. The consciousness is a unitary consciousness. And to recognize that, there is only one way. We cannot recognize a guru because he says he is a guru. Some fool may dress himself up and say he is a guru. He may be a charlatan, he may be self-deluded. And there may be a very holy man who never speaks about himself. He will not speak about himself. And when we come into contact with him, we may not know that he is a holy man. How can we know? We can know only if there is some inner sense within us. Not the physical eyes, not the ears which hear some words, but some inner sense within which responds to his vibration, so to speak. His magnetism, his atmosphere. I don't know whether those words mean something, but there has to be a response. Someone looks at a flower and he responds to the beauty of the flower. One can't say what makes him respond. It is something in his consciousness. There are other people who look at the same flower and they just don't respond, or they respond very superficially. They say, yes, the flower is nice, pass by. But it hasn't touched them in some way. So what makes things touch us? What calls forth something within us? This is something so intangible. It is a quality of consciousness within us. The very capacity to respond comes at only when there is a diminishing egoism in the individual. And that response, you might have heard J. Krishnamurti say, it's not a question of responding to something. I like a rose, so I say, yes, I appreciate beauty, I know how to respond. But then, when there is a poverty-stricken man near me, I don't see him. There is no response there. It is not what I call response. It is only that the rose gives me pleasure, so I like it. But Krishnaji says that if one is sensitive to beauty, there is no such thing as being sensitive to beauty without being sensitive to ugliness. And that is true of so many things. If we are not sensitive in general, sensitive to what people feel around us, whether there is disorder, whether there is cleanliness, how the animals are, how the earth is treated, what is our close relationship with people, if there is not a general response to everything around us, how can we respond when we come into contact with an enlightened person? Because the very capacity to respond is not within us. So the question of being able to come into touch with a great perfected person, a true guru, is connected with our whole mode of life. And therefore, there have been those who have said that truth is really something which cannot be communicated in words. There are great philosophical works, religious works, and mystical works, and we may read them and we learn the words and we think we know the truth. But that is not the truth. The truth is something that the heart, a certain inner nature within us, responds to, which it immediately feels is the truth. So in one of the Mahatma letters, which were written, I think, to A.P. Sinnett, one of the adepts who founded the Theosophical Society, he says that truth is incommunicable except to those who are really prepared for it. And if it were not so, all that the enlightened men of the world, there are not many, all that they would have to do is to issue a handbook. He puts it in a very amusing way. He says he can issue a handbook and have it taught in schools as they would teach grammar. That would be a very simple thing. But the adepts are not able to do that and to change the world in that manner, because the person who has to learn has to prepare himself to learn. And that means that he must create, he must have a quality of consciousness within him which is able to respond to what the adept has to communicate intangibly, not merely in words. And to do that, there are tested methods. The methods include, of course, meditation. There are many young people, particularly all over the world, who are interested in meditation. This is another vast subject. What is meditation? Meditation is not the same as repeating certain things. You know, there are people who believe that if they go on repeating something, then they reach a different state. Of course, by repeating something, one can hypnotize oneself into a condition of tranquility. But that is very different from a state of inward realization and peace, which comes when there is spiritual understanding. This is as good as taking a drug. One can go on repeating something, and or one can take a pill and silence one's brain. It is not the silencing of the mind which is a different thing. The mind gets silenced only when there is the absence of egoism. As long as there is the sense of self, the self is always wanting something, it is not silence. It is trying to get something. It will move. It will have hidden desires. Then there is the subconscious, the unconscious, and the conscious. All these things exist. And the real silence is when there is no sense of self, and therefore there is not this movement of the mind. So by merely repeating something, one can not create that condition of silence in which the truth is reflected. And so this kind of mechanical pursuits will not lead anywhere. There are many teachers who provide this kind of mechanical things. It may do some good, I don't know. It is possible that if one can reduce one's blood pressure by repeating certain things and make the pulse rate slower, it may be good from that point of view. Perhaps it is better not to have high blood pressure. Safer anyway. And so one can do that. It may have its own effect. Similarly, one may do asanas or do some breathing exercises. It may do good at a certain level. When one does asanas, it certainly keeps the physical body in good condition. Then it improves the blood circulation, so the brain may function better. And of course, it is very necessary that the brain should function better. If the brain is dull, if it is diseased, surely one cannot meditate and realize the truth. And so it is very important to keep the brain alert, in good condition. And similarly, breathing exercises may set up a certain rhythm in the body, and that may also be good, because when there is no rhythm, when there is no poise, if one is agitated, jittery, it creates an agitation of the mind also. You know, there is a psychosomatic relationship, the mind and the body. The body does, the mind reacts to. What the mind does, the body reacts to. If you can try it, if you are walking, if you walk in a jittery fashion, you know, hurry like that, it agitates the mind. You try walking rhythmically, slowly, and you will find it has an effect on the mind. Everything has an effect like that. So these outward things may have their own function at a certain level, but one must not equate them with the enlightenment or spirituality, which is something concerned with consciousness, with the state of one's mind, of one's heart, with one's whole being, one's relationship with the world, with a relationship which is not a superficial relationship. And to reach that condition, that state of mind, which is one which the Upanishads say, it is that by which all else is known. Because there is a state of mind which prepares it for knowledge, for truth, spiritual knowledge. To achieve that, there is only one way, and that is to reduce the selfishness, the self-centeredness, the sense of security, wanting to be, which is within the mind. And to do that, a certain discipline is necessary. We have to watch ourselves. Krishnaji once said, when he was a young man, I'm watching my mind as a cat does a mouse. You know, it's a very interesting statement. And we have to watch ourselves day by day to understand how this self is acting, what it is trying to do, how it bursts out into passion because it wants something or it doesn't want something, how the mind wanders because it is seeking. We may say, I am not seeking, but my mind wanders. But it is not so. It is like the butterfly. Our late president explained that. You know, a butterfly is flitting about, and we can say it's flitting about idly. But the fact is, it has sucked the honey of some flower, and some vague remembrance of the sweetness, the pleasure of it is there in its consciousness. So it flits around, hoping there is honey somewhere else. Very natural for a butterfly. But that is what our mind does. It flits about, it wanders aimlessly, because the taste of pleasure, of what the mind wants, of the things it has experienced and sought, is in the mind. So there is really one way to find the guru, to find the truth, and that is to understand oneself, to eliminate all these movements which are of the self seeking something else, which requires discipline, which requires that one's animal passions have to be controlled, which requires, as one of the adepts said in the Mahatma letters, a chastity of mind, an austerity in one's outlook, which is not a stupid thing like sitting in some place and, you know, torturing the body, which is quite a different thing. So there is the search for truth has implications at all levels of existence. The way one leads one's physical life, one's feelings, one's thoughts, one's words, all that are part of the life that have to be lived. And what I am saying has been known for centuries in all the philosophies. Whether you read, as one of the Mahatmas said, whether you read Iamblichus or the Vedanta, they will say the same thing, that there are age-old methods which have to be followed, and only then one reaches a certain state of consciousness which is able to respond to the truth or to the master, to the guru. And there is no difference between the truth and the guru. In fact, a real guru is an embodiment of truth, and that truth is the truth of an absolute sense of unity, of a total identity, of a wonderful feeling of compassion with all that lives. So the search for truth is a vast field, and it is, to use a term which so many people are using for other things, it's really an exciting adventure.